Watch your language. Remember whom you're speaking to. To the ladies, speak Italian. To the gentlemen, French. To the birds, English. To the dogs, German. And Spanish should be spoken only to God.
A Word in Your Ear. A study in language. A program in the series Ways of Mankind. Presented under the supervision of Walter Goldschmidt of the University of California, Los Angeles, by the National Association of Educational Broadcasters. A series designed to show how human beings live together in different times and places. A study in language. A word in your ear. All people have language with which to express their feelings.
But language is not the same as expressing your feelings. Some people think animals have language because they can often express their feelings, as when in the Arctic wilderness we hear the wolf.
But there is all the difference in the world between that wolf and this.
The four-legged wolf howl expresses its feelings there and then, and so does the wolf whistle. But the whistler can back up his expression with language.
How about taking in a show on Saturday night?
And that is a communication about another time and another place. It is true language, not just expression of feeling. And all human beings have language. From the Eskimo by the Arctic Sea, warm in his kayak with his suit of furs, to the Patagonian by the Antarctic Sea, shivering in his canoe with a fire in it because he wears almost no clothes at all. From one extreme to the other, all people have language.
What's more, all these languages are adequate. They all do the job. Communication.
But we often think that whatever we speak ourselves is the proper thing. What the other fellow speaks is scarcely more than a string of grunts.
Oh, I see by the paper there are over 1,500 different languages spoken in the world today.
Huh?
And it says there are more families of languages among the American Indians than in the whole of the old world.
Uh-huh.
Well, everyone knows Indians don't talk properly. They just grunt.
Uh-huh.
You aren't listening. Are you?
Hmm?
Are you listening?
Mm-hmm.
I say Indians don't talk properly. They just grunt.
Hmm?
Grunt.
Hmm.
Well, what do you think?
Language is language and grunts are grunts.
One man's speech is another man's jargon. But all people have language, and these languages are highly diverse in form. But always, we begin by speaking as we think, and end by thinking as we speak. Our language is an expression of our culture, shaped by the way we are brought up. And, on the other hand, the way we are brought up is shaped by our language.
For, as we know from our own language, English, language reflects place, time, age, sex, and circumstance. And this is true of other languages.
Language reflects place.
As everybody knows, very often the most foreign thing about a foreign country is the foreign language.
And English speakers can't visit one another's country without meeting the great transatlantic rift.
Look, Jack, when you get off the streetcar, get off the pavement, get on the sidewalk, go two blocks, turn right, there's the drugstore on the corner. Take the elevator down to the garage, you can't miss it.
All right, chump, you mean when I get off the tram, get off the road, get on the pavement, take your second turning to the right, there's a chemist shop on the corner, take your left out of the garage. What do you mean I can't miss it?
Language, then, is a function of place.
And language is a function of time. Listen to the Lord's Prayer as it sounded nearly 600 years ago.
Our Father that art in heavenest, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come to. Be thy will done as in heaven and in earth. Give to us this day our bread, our other substance, and forgive to us our debtors, as we forgive to our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
Then, quite soon after the Norman conquest, English had a tang of French to it. But let's jump back beyond 1066 and listen to English in its hard Teutonic infancy as Anglo-Saxon. the Lord's Prayer, in the year 1000 A.D.
Fede ura sus eert an hoffnum sith in name gehalget, to become sin rica, ge worda sin willa on yorten swaswa an hoffnum, ur ne gedeich wamlik an hlaaf sila us to deg, and forgive us ura giltus swaswa we forgive us urum giltendum, at ne gelied zu us on kostninga, ac alisus of ifele, soth like.
Language, then, is a function of time. And even modern English still keeps the record of that Norman conquest. The Saxons became the servants and looked after the beasts while they were alive. And their names are still the Saxon ones.
Ox, calf, sheep, swine.
Compare the German. Ox, kalb, schaf, Schwein.
But when they were killed, their meat was served up to the Norman master. And on the table, those animals' names are still the Norman ones.
Beef, veal, mutton, pork.
Compare the French. Bœuf, veau, mouton, porc. Language reflects culture.
Language is a function of age. We don't expect a child to talk like a college professor.
Simple harmonic motion can therefore be represented graphically by a sine or cosine curve.
Nor do we expect a college professor to talk like a child.
What's the matter, said the doctor? What's the matter, said the nurse? What's the matter, said the lady with the alligator purse?
Language is also a function of sex. Among the Carayahi Indians of Brazil, the women and the men speak different languages. For example, the word for girl is Yadokoma in the women's language, but Yadoma in the men's.
And in English? Here's a traveler chewing his cigar in the smoking room of the Santa Fe chief, but he's speaking the women's language.
I don't want to be catty, but my dear, it was simply too terrible. I really thought I should have died. I just wanted to sink right through the floor. My gracious me, I thought if Bert and Charlie aren't wearing that same cunning Homburg hat.
Unfortunately, in our society, the men's language is taboo to women. That is to say, they are supposed not to know it. So I'm afraid we don't dare give you an example of a lady speaking the men's language. Sailors present.
Language is a function of occasion. There is a time for one kind of speech and a time for another. Sir James Fraser tells us that in Siam, there is a special language to be used when discussing the Siamese king. When he eats or drinks or walks, a special word indicates that these acts are being performed by the sovereign, and such words cannot possibly be applied to the acts of any other person whatever.
We do not perhaps carry things quite as far as that. But nonetheless, a fellow may be greeted when he comes into the office by...
Hi, Charlie boy, how's the kid? What do you got to say for yourself?
But a few minutes later, when the board meeting convenes, he is asked...
And now, Charles, we trust you have overcome the hardships of your journey. Would you be so good as to present your report regarding market conditions in the West?
The Chinese, of course, are famous for their elaborate forms of greeting. But other languages are far more complicated. For example... The Nootka Indians of Vancouver Island not only distinguish by the choice of words the sex of the person speaking, the sex of the person spoken to, and whether the speaker is more or less important than the person spoken to, but also on top of this have a special way of talking to a man who is left-handed and a special way of talking to a man who is circumcised.
English cannot go this far. But even so, language must be suitable to the occasion. Queen Victoria certainly knew this when she expressed her dislike of Gladstone in the words...
Mr. Gladstone always addresses me as if I were a public meeting.
And imagine a politician proposing in the language he uses on the platform.
Unaccustomed as I am to private proposals, I kneel before you today, unwilling, nay, reluctant, to assume the burdens of matrimonial office, but nonetheless... prepared to bow to your opinion and dedicate myself unselfishly if I receive an unmistakable draft.
Language, therefore, by reflecting place, time, age, sex, and circumstance, is a function of society. Language reflects culture.
The easiest way to see this is through vocabulary. The Eskimos have no word for coconut, and the Samoans have no word for snow.
And neither do the Eskimos.
I beg your pardon?
We Eskimos have no word for snow. Ask me the word for snow, and I ask you what kind of snow. Snow is to us Eskimos too important to be dismissed with one word. We have many words telling us, for instance, when it fell and describing its exact condition to us. For the knowledge is vital and our lives may depend on it.
Since language reflects society, whatever is important in society has many words in the language. The Arabs have 1,000 words for sword, and the Siberian Chukchi that live on the shores of the Arctic Ocean have 30 or so words describing the skins of the caribou, as, for example, this one.
Shechenya kishlam.
This word means that the underleg of the caribou skin is grayish. Also, that it is light gray on the groins, but that the prevailing body color is brown. And there are innumerable similar examples. The Yurok Indians of California place a high value on woodpecker scalps and obsidian blades. And besides the ordinary set of numerals, 1, 2, 3, and so forth, they have 2 extra sets, one for counting woodpecker scalps and another one for counting obsidian blades.
English is full of relics of vocabulary that remind us that other days thought other things important. There was a time when English-speaking men lived very much by hunting. They had special words for congregations of animals, a flock of sheep and a herd of cattle, but a pride of lions, a skulk of foxes, and a gaggle of geese. They also had special words for the carving of each of the animals and birds of the chase when they arrived on the table ready to eat. Nowadays, if we saw a pile of game birds and wanted them carved, the cook might say,
"Hey, Mac.
Yeah?
Cut up them birds, will you?"
For nowadays, one game bird is much like another. Out of season.
But to the Elizabethans, game birds were the very meat of life, and their carving required a special and ornate vocabulary.
You, sitter.
Anon?
Dismember that heron, unbrace that mallard, allay that pheasant, wing that partridge, display that quail. Unjoint that bittern, thigh that woodcock, lift that swan, and rear that goose. As for that curlew...
Aye, sir.
Unlatch it.
A noble handful that has been replaced by other rich treasures of vocabulary, as our language, like all other languages, has changed to reflect our culture.
As we Eskimos found out when I was sent down to study your language. Your language is like ours very often. Our Eskimo language, like many other North American Indian languages, is polysynthetic.
How's that polysynthetic?
Not Eskimo word, English word. Polysynthetic.
Oh.
One word means a whole phrase. One word has in it the compressed wreckage of a phrase. Thus, suppose we wish to say in Eskimo this. When they were about to go out, they would take the boot stretcher, using it to thrash the dogs, because they usually stay in the entrance passage. That is 28 words in English. In Eskimo, it is 6 words. Anilarunik, when they were about to go out. Kamiut, the boot stretcher. Tingusa, they would take it. Anataralongo, using it to thrash with. Kimit, the dogs. Torsone, Teomata, because they usually stay in the entrance passage.
But where does English contain words that are the compressed wreckage of a phrase, as you put it?
In English, not exactly like Eskimo, but nearly like. The other day, I saw a newspaper headline.
UNRWA DP's Laud UNESCO.
UNRWA DP's Laud UNESCO. Back to my dictionary I go. There I find the word Laud, nothing else. The other words are missing. Then it is explained to me. These other words are not normal English. They are instead the compressed wreckage of phrases. And 4 words, UNRWA DP's Laud UNESCO, means...
United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Agency, Displaced Persons, Laud the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization.
17 words compressed into 4. Well, that is about the average for Eskimo.
Again, language reflects culture. As modern life sets up more elaborate agencies and organizations, modern language adapts itself and forms words and builds polysynthetic forms almost like the Eskimo. Other languages besides English have been doing this. German, for example. Gestapo stands for Geheime Staatspolizei, secret state police. FLAC is the compressed wreckage of Flugzeugabwehrkanone, anti-aircraft cannon.
As we think, so we speak. As we speak, so we think. As we are taught reading, writing, and arithmetic, as we are taught our manners and the way things are done in the world we live in, so we are taught our language. And as we learn our language from our mother's lips, we also learn the customs and attitudes of our society. For language reflects these customs and attitudes. That is, language reflects culture.
Over here, for instance, here's a child misbehaving, and here comes its mother. She's going to tell it to behave properly, but let us notice carefully what word she uses.
John, be good.
Be good. The English-speaking child that misbehaves is bad, it is naughty, it is wicked. So is the Italian-speaking child or the Greek-speaking one.
But listen to what the French mother says to her child.
Jean, sois sage.
Sois sage. Be wise. The French-speaking child that misbehaves is not bad. It is foolish. It is imprudent. It is injudicious.
In the Scandinavian countries, things are different again. The Swedish mother says...
Jan, var snäll.
And the Norwegian mother says...
Jan, bli snäll.
Both mean the same thing. Be friendly. Be kind. So the misbehaving Scandinavian child is unfriendly, unkind, uncooperative.
Things are very different in Germany.
Hans, sei artig.
Be in line. The misbehaving German child is not conforming. It is out of step, out of line. A mother of the Hopi Indians of the Southwest United States has the same idea, only in a more gentle spirit, when she tells her child,
No, no, no. That is not the Hopi way.
Hopi is the right thing. The proper way to do things, the way the affairs of the tribe and indeed of the universe are managed. The Hopi child that misbehaves is not bad, nor imprudent, nor unfriendly, nor quite out of line. He is not on the Hopi way. He is not in step with the Hopi view of destiny and of life.
So even in the words a mother says to her misbehaving child, we can detect again how language reflects culture.
Johnny, be good.
Jean, sois sage, be wise.
Jan, was snell, be friendly.
Hans, sei artig, get back in step.
No, 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 that is not the Hopi way.
East of New Guinea in the southern Pacific lie the Trobriand Islands. The people who live there are great mariners, lively and active, but they take no interest in things changing. If a thing changes, then it becomes something else, and they call it something else.
Just as we do not introduce an old gentleman with a long white beard as the bouncing baby boy, Jim Jones.
Very pleased to make your acquaintance.
Buster here isn't any more a bouncing baby boy than I am.
Ah, but you see, once upon a time I was, in the long, long ago.
But he isn't now. And in fact, we don't think of him as a kind of modified infant, but as something else, an old gentleman, a different kind of animal.
Now, the Trobriand Islanders think like this all the time. They raise a yam crop, and a first-rate yam is called...
Taitu.
But an overripe yam is not overripe Taitu. It's different. It's...
Yawana.
And a Yawana with underground shoots isn't Yawana anymore, but...
Silisata.
Though with new tubers on the underground shoots, it isn't Silisata of any kind, but rather...
Gardena.
Among the Trobriand Islanders, in short, the name of a thing alone is all you need say about it.
How different with us. Consider the case of a fellow being shown a new baby. Red-faced, boiled-looking, dribbling, cross-eyed, and squalling. The fond parents are watching you like hawks. You have to say something. But what?
How intelligent-looking?
Well, it looks like a moron.
How beautiful?
Just look at the ugly little beast.
How small and tiny?
For that, they'll kill you. He's 3/32 of an ounce overweight. He's a giant.
How exactly like his father?
Say that and he'll punch you right in the nose. There's nothing you can say. All you can do is shuffle around from one foot to the other and look as foolish as the baby.
But in the Trobriand Islands, the whole thing's simple. Show a Trobriand Islander the same messy, bellowing brat, and he says...
How baby.
How baby. Which nobody can deny. And everyone's happy.
Yet our language is like the Trobriand in some ways, just as our society is like theirs in some ways. They place a high value on yams and have an elaborate yam vocabulary. We place a high value on other things and have an even more complicated and exact vocabulary to describe the special objects of our interest. Just look here. Standing on a downtown street corner, we have a Trobriand Islander. He's come to study our society. He's talking to a guy and writing down the answers.
What is the name of that thing on wheels going by now, the green one?
That's a Plymouth.
Plymouth. There's another green one. Also a Plymouth?
No, it's green, but it ain't a Plymouth. That's a Studebaker. Studi has kind of a turret in the middle.
Then here is a great big Studebaker.
No, the big one with the kind of turret, that's a Cadillac.
Here is another big one. That is a Cadillac?
No, look at the back. That's a Lincoln.
And so it goes on, of course. That Trobriander will be there for a week. And then we'll break it to him that there's a difference between the 51 model and the 52. A week? He'll be there for a year.
But when he does go home, he'll talk to his friends just as our travelers come home and talk to us.
They are a very peculiar people, attaching fantastic importance to little differences between their automobiles, so that a certain kind of small automobile is called a Plymouth. But with a turret in the middle, it is not a Plymouth with a turret, but a Studebaker. Quite a different word. And a big thing like a sort of Studebaker with other differences here and there is not a big Studebaker, but a different word again, a Cadillac. And so it goes on. They are a very peculiar people.
How Trobriand. But now we end with the most striking and interesting example of language reflecting culture. The wonderful and varied language of the Navajo Indians. The Navajo Indians live in the great red desert of the southwest United States, not very far from the Grand Canyon in Arizona. Their nomadic life is filled with uncertainties, and they seek security and balance in ritual and ceremony, by which they find their place in the natural harmony of the universe, and health, and a sense of belonging.
Now, life on this vast, unconsidering mountain desert is very much influenced by forces the Navajo do not command. The long drought, sudden torrential rain, the sweep of epidemic disease.
And the Navajo view of the universe seems to be connected with what they have learned from the country that is their home.
We try to control nature.
We seek to understand it and our place within it.
To us, the world is made up of beings and things that act on other beings and things.
To us Navajo, the world is one of actions and events associated with things, among which our own acts are only a few among many.
Our outlook is centered on things. Our language is centered on nouns, which are the names of things. The first words our children learn might well be the names of things.
Man, ball, boat, bird.
Our Navajo outlook is focused on actions and events, our language on verbs. The first words our children learn may well be those expressive of actions.
Standing, rolling, sailing, flying.
Navajo words, like those of Eskimo, are often polysynthetic, the compressed wreckage of phrases. Take this single word.
Nash-ah.
And it means, I am causing a round object to turn over.
Navajo has many words for what we speak of as moving. A word for a round object moving, a fabric moving, and many more. And pronouns and adverbs are only parts of the verb, for the verb is central in Navajo speech, just as actions are central in Navajo thinking.
We have a few verbs that are perhaps similar. The word shrug must carry with it the idea of shoulder. You can't shrug your stomach.
In English, we say, John is dying, just as we say, John is walking or John is working, for we speak even of death as though it were an act performed. But the Navajo, translated, says something like,
dying is taking place with John.
We are active toward nature. We think of our world as full of objects doing things to other objects. Our language is centered on nouns, the names of things.
We Navajo see ourselves as part of nature, in harmony with it. Our world is one of actions to which we and other things are linked. Our language centers on the verb, expressive of acting.
Finally, here is an editorial in a Navajo newspaper. The writer is angry. He wants to know why a school is not built at Kayenta, though other places have schools. But he expresses his indignation in the Navajo way.
The school at Kayenta, in vain we are hoping for it. Many children here have no school to attend. To one who comes here to see, there are 300 or more children who are in this state, who have no school. Therefore, let a school become a reality here at Kayenta. Long ago, this matter was brought up. Why is this so, please?
Did you notice how this Navajo was expressing indignation? The things he is angry about are described as occurrences, as something just naturally happens. You and I wouldn't take this point of view. We'd look for the person or thing responsible, someone to blame. This difference is in our language, just as it is in our thinking. In English, we emphasize nouns, which are the names of things. The Navajo emphasizes verbs, which indicate action. And the noun is just incorporated in the verb itself. These cultural differences, which are part and parcel of language, are the real stumbling blocks to all translation. As a matter of fact, we lost some of the true Navajo flavor in translating the speech, as you might well believe. Language is peculiarly human. No animal society has a language. Aristotle spoke of man as a political animal, but the fact is that other animals do have social systems, and the distinction is far from clear. But animals, though they can and do communicate, lack our ability to recreate experience in words. They can't accumulate knowledge and transmit it from one generation to another and build thereby the large and complex systems of behaving we call cultures. In fact, it is fair to say that without this ability, without this unique gift, cultures would be impossible, and therefore it is a crucial one to man's unique position in the world. Though languages may differ widely from each other in sounds and vocabulary and grammar, all are adequate as systems of communication within the societies in which they are found. The language of each society, however, sets for its speakers certain modes of observation and interpretation, and quite literally creates for them their own world of social reality. As the linguist and anthropologist Edward Sapir put it, the worlds in which different societies live are distinct worlds, not merely the same world with different labels attached. Perhaps this fact can best be shown by pointing out that modern physicists, like Einstein, have had to develop a language, not just new words, in order to express what they now believe to be the true nature of matter and of the universe.
Dr. Walter Goldschmidt, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Sociology of the University of California, Los Angeles, has concluded a study in culture in the series Ways of Mankind. Ways of Mankind comes to you each week at this time through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.